It has been quite a week, has it not? If you think back the last 7 days or maybe the last 10 days. And somebody asked what I thought about Robert Reich's piece today, in which he said that the sleeping giant has awakened. And I'm going to agree. Now, you should be aware that I've been thinking this is coming now for literally years. So maybe take what I say with maybe a whole shaker of salt. But it feels to me like things are different now than they were 10 days ago. And that the American people are really paying attention now to what Trump and his loyalists are doing, and they are no longer giving those things the benefit of the doubt, which, you know, people usually do at the beginning of an administration. They tend to say, oh, well, you know, it's going to be good. It's going to be good change. And look at all that person promised, and we're going to get all that stuff. And in fact, we know from the polls, which are lower by the day, that the people who voted for Trump expecting him, for example, to make the economy better and lower inflation are dealing with the fact that the opposite has happened, that in fact, unemployment is higher and inflation is rising. And, you know, there are fewer job openings, and a lot of the things that he promised have not only not come to pass, we've seen the opposite. So they're looking at that. They're also looking at the fact, and I think this one's really interesting, that a lot of people thought that Trump was simply going to get rid of the criminal undocumented immigrants amongst us. As I've said, we had the mechanisms to do that anyway. One of the rich issues that, we had the mechanism to do that anyway, but when he kept talking about getting rid of the, you know, the worst of the worst and so on and so forth, what a lot of people didn't realize, and I remember having this argument with a MAGA voter back in last December, that the people in his orbit maintain that the very act of crossing the border without documentation makes you a criminal who is the worst of the worst. And a lot of people didn't expect to see grandmothers who'd been here for 30 years and all the people who have become part of the fabric of the United States be deported or even be rendered to third countries. And they're not happy with seeing that. And they're not happy with seeing the masked ICE agents on the streets. And they're not happy with the use of American troops in cities as well. So he's underwater on that. And he's underwater on all the other issues that he said he would do. And if you remember back during the campaign, I kept saying he's promising everything to everyone, even when the things he's promising are mutually incompatible. And you can't be wet and dry at the same time. So lots of people are going to get unhappy. And that's what you're seeing now. And we're coming now into the fall, into a period when you're going to see a lot of the policies that the administration has put in place starting really to have teeth, starting really to take effect, not least, and I'll talk more about this in the future, you know, in a little bit, the rise in the cost of health premiums for people who are buying healthcare insurance on the Affordable Care Act markets are facing extraordinary jumps in their premiums because of the one big beautiful act, which is what they are calling the Budget Reconciliation Bill Act, that the Republicans passed in July. It got rid of the tax credits for purchasing health insurance for people who made between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level. And that means that their premiums have gone up significantly, but that also means that healthier people have chosen not to enter the healthcare market. And that has meant that premiums for the people who are in it have also leaped up. And that's going to come back in before the end of this to haunt us in this moment. So there is this sense of dropping popularity for Trump, but what happened in the last 10 days seems to me to feel different, and I think to Robert Reich as well, and that is on the heels of the murder of Charlie Kirk, the right-wing activist in Utah about 10 days ago now. I think I've a little bit lost track of time. What you saw was the attempt of loyalists around the president to weaponize that murder to go after people they consider their political opponents. Before anybody had any idea even who the murderer was, and again, that person is now in custody but still is alleged because there has not been a trial and we haven't seen evidence and so on. But even before that, there was this concerted effort to tar everybody who did not agree with Trump and MAGA as a terrorist or as they or them or the Democrats or the left was responsible for this murder. That, I think, made people extremely uncomfortable, as it was very clear it was part of an attempt to stop criticism of the administration. And you saw that finally with the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr, saying on a podcast of a right-wing podcaster who before the election was one of those who was being funded by Russia, Carr saying that ABC News better think about continuing to have comedian Jimmy Kimmel on air because it needed a broadcast license, and you know there were other ways in which the FCC could come down on that person or on that company because they were permitting the spread of they couched it as an attack on the circumstances around Charlie Kirk's murder. But in fact, if you watch Jimmy Kimmel, which I had not until after this, you see that basically his monologues are a litany of attacks on Trump. And that, you know, if you don't know Kimmel, it seems pretty clear that's what was really going on. And that really came home to a lot of people for whom I think the Constitution and the rights that we enjoy in the United States seem somewhat abstract, that they couldn't think they could lose them. And all of a sudden, a number of people, including Ted Cruz, who is a senator from Texas, but who seems to spend most of his time now with it running his podcast, including Tucker Carlson, a right-wing media personality, a lot of people who use their platforms in ways that can certainly be offensive, sort of said, wait a minute here, we've really got to protect the Constitution. And the outcry among the American people with the sudden recognition that they too could be on the wrong side of a government that was willing to do that made such pressure on Disney, which owns ABC, which is the employer of, or the person, the group that runs Jimmy Kimmel Live, reversed course yesterday, and Jimmy Kimmel will be back on the air tonight. Jimmy Kimmel Live will be back on the air tonight. And people have said, will he have been cowed? And in that case, hasn't everybody lost? Now, listen, I am not somebody who knows that much at all about that TV world. But if you look at what Stephen Colbert did after his show was not renewed, he has certainly, I think, not pulled any punches at all. I mean, I think he's more outspoken than he was before. And I would be shocked if Kimmel doesn't do the same thing, because in a sense, he has been inoculated. But I don't know anything really about him or his habits. So somebody who else knows him might be able to fill people in more than that. But the point is that with that out there, a number of things became pretty apparent last week, I think, about the administration that maybe people weren't paying attention to. So on the heels of that whole brouhaha, you had what appeared to be a direct message from Trump to Attorney General Pam Bondi, in which he expressed fury that the interim interim person who was the U.S. attorney for the district that was looking at whether or not New York Attorney General Letitia James had committed mortgage fraud, which seemed pretty clearly to be a trumped up charge, that hadn't really happened. And this was an attempt of the administration to go after, use the law to go after her. And it also expressed fury that same person had decided not to pursue a case against James Comey, the former FBI director, who had refused to drop the case looking into whether members of Trump's 2016 campaign had been working alongside Russian operatives, or the connections between the two. Both of them were, the administration had pushed investigations of them based on what really seemed to be trumped up charges. And this interim U.S. attorney, Eric Siebert, who was very well regarded both by Republicans and by Democrats, said, I'm not going to prosecute this. I don't have evidence for that. And Trump wrote what appeared to be a direct message that he then, of course, posted for everyone to see to Pam Bondi, the attorney general, and said, this is ridiculous. You've got to go after these guys. We know they've committed crimes. I can just tell they've committed crimes, and we have to go after them. And then he reiterated that to reporters in the Oval Office. And of course, that weaponization of the political system is one that has been pretty obvious to those paying close attention for a while. But I think seeing it in black and white like that from the president really opened up the eyes of a lot of people to recognize that anybody could be next. Crossing the president made it clear that they could find someone, as was quoted on social media. You know, that's something that one of the members of communist secret police forces have said, you know, find the man and I'll show you the crime. I'll find something on anybody. And of course, that would be wildly impeachable for any other presidency. There was also the fact that Tom Homan, who is now Trump's border czar, his actual title is that he's an advisor to the president. Is apparently, allegedly, on video. The FBI caught him on video in 2024, accepting a bag of worth of $50,000 with $50,000 in it, in exchange for promising the FBI agents who were posing as business people that he would make sure they got contracts in border security in a new Trump administration. And the response in the administration to that was, first, well, he didn't commit a crime, even though that is a crime, and it certainly appears to be a crime. And secondly, the White House said he didn't ever take the money, and then Homan went out in public and said, well, what I did wasn't a crime. Well, you know, again, this is a group of people who spent 4 years trying to pin on Joe Biden the idea that he had somehow accepted a bribe, or that his son had accepted a bribe. And now they're saying, oh, never mind, I don't care. So there were all of those areas. And then there were a couple of others as well. The other one that jumps out are the extraordinary attacks on the American public health system by Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And that has been shown through changes to the vaccination schedule. And if you recall, he promised Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, who is himself a doctor, Robert Kennedy is not, that he wouldn't make changes to the vaccine systems in the U.S. And of course, as soon as he was confirmed, Kennedy went ahead and did that. He fired a whole bunch of people who are on the advisory committee for vaccines, and then they have begun the process of changing the vaccine schedules. And doctors and public health people recognize that this is a ticking time bomb. And similarly, the cuts to funding for cancer, for example, and the many ways in which the administration is attacking the public health system are really deeply problematic. And there is also, of course, what happened yesterday when Trump said he would have the FDA announce to physicians that for pregnant women to take acetaminophen during their pregnancies creates a very high risk of autism in their babies. There's just no evidence for that. There's been no change in the evidence we have. This is part of the crusade that Kennedy has been on. But again, doctors and public health people recognize that this is wildly dangerous for our public health system and for the American people. So all of those things happened at once. But why do things feel different? So I'm going to step back a little bit here and remind you that Trump all along has, since 2016, has been doing things that for any other president would be deal breakers. And he has never had to grapple with the consequences because the Republican Party supported him. No matter what he did, the Republican Party supported him, which itself is deeply problematic, but also a really interesting moment in our political history, that people who otherwise have taken oaths to the Constitution are walking away from their power to give everything over to one guy. But now things are different. And they feel different, I think, because Trump can no longer command the votes that he could even as recently as November 2024. And what I mean by that is that the Make America Healthy Again, the MAHA people, are furious at Kennedy for making a link between autism and acetaminophen or Tylenol. They wanted to see him say there was a link between autism and vaccines. And they're very angry that he did not do that. They're also angry that he has backed away from his previous claims about autism and pesticides, which is another thing that, again, a lot of researchers were exploring, and now he has backed off on that. So a lot of, even though the Kennedy is infuriating people like me who care about vaccines and public health, he's also infuriating those people who turned out for Trump because he is not delivering on their pet peeves. Similarly, one of the big things for Trump getting into office in 2024 were the people who wanted to see the release of the Epstein files. That is, the government files that were compiled during the investigation of Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted sex offender. And that, again, the Trump administration ran on, they promised, and then after, in July of this year, backed off and said, no, we're not going to release anything. There were no files, and that case is closed. Well, then, of course, things started to leak, in which after Elon Musk had said in June that Trump was in the Epstein files, the Wall Street Journal then confirmed that later on in July, as I recall. And now we have seen some of the material. Oh, now we've actually seen the whole birthday book that was bound in leather for Jeffrey Epstein's 50th birthday. And we have seen really suggestive, horrific things in that book. We've also seen increasing public appearances by the victims, the survivors of Epstein and his associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is in prison, but it has been moved to a work camp, a much less strict prison than the one she was in after talking to the Department of Justice. And a lot of people are really angry that the Epstein files are not coming out. Now, on top of all that, in this moment, there are also a couple of other big things hanging out there. One is that the farming community in the United States is hurting really badly because of the tariffs that Trump imposed, most of which, a federal judge has found illegal. Now, that's going to go in front of the United States Supreme Court, and if I have time, I'll tell you more about what they're up to. But that part of the country that voted for Trump and believed that he was going to be really good for them is now hurting terribly badly because of the tariffs, especially the soybean farmers who used to sell a significant part of their crop to China and have lost all of that market. China has now gone to another country for their soybeans, and they do not have a market for those soybeans. And at the same time, they're losing a lot of their undocumented help, or even documented help, who are like, we're out of here. We're scared to show up because we're going to get into these ICE sweeps, and we can't prove that we're here legally if our papers aren't on us. So especially now the Supreme Court has said that racial profiling is okay. So that's another major Trump voting group that I'm not saying they're ever going to vote Democratic, but they may not turn out for Trump again. And then there is also what you are seeing is in this moment is a lot of the things that went into place with the cuts that the Department of Government Efficiency made and that the Russell Vogt at the Office of Management and Budget, one of the key writers of Project 2025, has done. A lot of those clawing back of money that Congress had appropriated for education, for example, or for public health, or for universities, the clawing back of that money has badly hurt Republican districts. Because Republican districts tend to be rural. And because they tend to be rural, they tend to be significantly older. And they tend to rely more on federal money because they have less of a tax base than urban areas that have younger people in them and have more people in them and more industry in them. So a lot of red areas are furiously angry at what is happening around them, to the point that, as you know, a lot of Republican lawmakers are not holding town halls because they're afraid to go in front of their constituents and they don't want to be screamed at. All right. So somebody just asked, can I comment about the UN? That's where I was going. So all of that background is there over the last week. But before I talk about the UN, have you noticed anything about President Trump lately, or J.D. Vance, the vice president? You know, Trump is always sitting by the behind the Resolute desk when he's in the Oval Office, with people standing behind him. You know, he doesn't move around very much. And when he is out, he often seems to be falling asleep. And he doesn't seem to hold many high-level meetings. I'll talk about that again in a minute. And when he talks, if you remember, the White House is no longer providing transcripts of his speeches, which is odd. I mean, that's part of the public record. They're supposed to do that, and they've just decided they're not going to do it. And they say, oh, well, you know, we've got, you can watch clips. But those clips are edited. And the reason that I'm suggesting all that is because he seems unable to fill the role of the president any longer. He is incoherent. He is boastful to the point of, I mean, he sounds like an unregulated toddler. And he doesn't seem to be able really to communicate with people anymore in meaningful ways. Instead, what he is doing is increasingly boasting about a world that is not true. He keeps talking about how his poll numbers are the best in history. They're actually among the worst in history, and they're dropping. And he keeps talking about how America has conquered inflation. Well, no, inflation's on its way back up again. You know, I mean, that's just wrong. Talks about how strong the job market is. No, it's not. Talks about how well his tariffs are and all these tariffs he has negotiated. No, he hasn't. You know, now he's talking about all these wars he has stopped, even some wars that hadn't even, you know, nobody even knew they were going to start. That's just a fantasy. That's not true at all. At the same time, he is increasingly backing away and refusing to deal with difficult issues. That being said, he certainly seems as if he is not able to fulfill the role of the president, and he's living in this sort of fantasy bubble. All right, so this morning, he went to the UN, it's called the General Debate, and it's not a debate. It's where, it's actually really cool, and you can read the transcripts if you're interested and watch the videos on the UN website if you are interested, as I was. And what happens in the general debate, it's just what it's called. Like I say, they're not debating, is the heads of government or of state speak to the group of people who are assembled at the UN about what their priorities and what their plans are going forward. So what happened this morning was that the Secretary General gave the speech that you would expect, saying, please remember, this is the 80th year of the UN. And the reason we have the UN is because after World War II, the world's leaders decided, the Allies decided that they were going to create a world in which they could avoid World War III because World War II had been so horrible. So they created this system to establish a set of rules that would enable us to argue out wars before they start. And I'm going to do a little bit of an aside here and point out that that's a really amazing idea. If you think about the way treaties used to work, that you had treaties that if you went to war, other countries would join you. And if you were attacked, other countries would fight with you. The idea that you can have treaties to stop wars, to make sure that those things don't happen, is really kind of amazing. And what they did with the establishment of the UN was the idea of creating a world where you didn't have to solve everything with force. So he gets up there and he says, you know, this is important and we want to make sure this stays in place, even though a lot of people are, there's a lot of challenges to that around the world. And, you know, he gives a speech and then somebody else speaks. Trump is fourth, as I recall. And he gets up and he speaks for an hour and it is freaking unhinged. He says he's the only one who knows how to run things, that he even says to the people assembled that their countries are going to hell and he's the only one who knows how to run a country, and that they're ruining their countries because of immigration and clean energy, and that we really need to do is have borders and fossil fuels. And he's just insulting, and then he just starts going about how he solved all these wars and he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. And you can just see on their faces, they are aghast. And not, I think, aghast because they were offended. There's actually somebody who there texted a reporter and said, he's barking mad. Do the American people not recognize what's going on here? And that performance at the UN was, I think, a window into America, the United States of America, more than it was a statement about the United States on the world stage. Because he was totally insulting and all that. But he was also not, I mean, you could see the white nationalism that had Stephen Miller's hand in it. And you could see that isolationism as well. But that was not the gist of that hour-long rambling speech at all. I mean, it was really eye-popping. So then what happened? What happened is that Trump had a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine and basically came out and said, yeah, I'm going to back you. No, he didn't say this. He said, looks like Ukraine can win and Russia can't. And, you know, America's going to stand behind NATO and basically sort of said, I'm done. You guys, good luck. And that's a big deal. It appears that less than how many weeks ago was he saying that he was backing Russia and that Russia should take all of Ukraine? And now he turned around and said, well, actually, Ukraine can get all of its land back and probably more. Because, of course, as we know, Russia's in terrible economic shape right now. So it was just off the charts, weird, but also indicative that people who are interested in governance or in power, perhaps is a better way to put it, are almost certainly already thinking about what comes next. And I just mean, who knows? J.D. Vance is the next person in line to be president. He does not have his own popular following, although he is working extremely hard to step into Charlie Kirk's shoes. He did Charlie Kirk's podcast or webcast or whatever it was and spoke at his service and was one of the more memorable speakers there. And, you know, he's trying to pick up a younger group of people behind Christian nationalism. But in this moment, if you are a business person or a television exec or whatever, and certainly if you are a Republican lawmaker trying to figure out how best to retain your power, it is no longer clear that the best way to retain your power is to side with MAGA. It may, in fact, be that the best way to retain your power is to look at the extraordinary backlash against the firing of Jimmy Kimmel. And remember that when you do the numbers, only about 32% of American adults voted for Trump. And G. Elliot Morris, who does Strength in Numbers, explained this very well the other day, that although Trump did win the last election with under 50% of the vote, only 64% of eligible voters showed up to vote. So that translates to about 32% of American adults being Trump voters in 2024. And of course, his popularity has plummeted since then. So if you're sitting there making this calculation, you can say, well, hold on just a minute. If he had 32% and now that's dropping and everybody else is energized against him, maybe my next move is not to stay behind MAGA. Maybe my next move is to figure out where the center of power in the American electorate is. And that's where we come in. We come in by continuing to ratchet up that pressure. Not, as I say, to convert the MAGA voters or the MAGA lawmakers, but to remember that there are a lot of people retiring this year, mostly Republicans, and there will be people filling their slots. And if we want them to do what we want them to, we need to make them understand what that looks like. And certainly, ABC News or Disney figured out what that looks like. And the pressure that we can bring to bear for the other issues we care about, that is exactly how you translate the things you care about into law. Now, one of the places you're going to see this play out in the next few weeks is over funding the U.S. government. That the Republicans, MAGAs, or the Republicans in general have a real problem in that they have maintained that the cuts that Doge and Trump have and vote have made to the American government are good. That the United States needs to spend less money so it can have these tax cuts for the very wealthy and corporations. Well, the bad news is that Americans are discovering that they don't want those things. So it is not really possible for them to square the circle that says the way you make a country great is through tax cuts and deregulation, when in fact the American people are saying, hang on just a minute here, that's not what we want. And you can see if you look to Argentina, where Javier Milei did something very similar there, that billionaire Elon Musk used as a model for the Department of Government Efficiency. That economy is in real trouble and voters are sour on it, to the point that the U.S. under Trump is talking about propping Argentina up to try and keep that experiment going. So going forward into this budget mess, you've got the Republicans controlling all the branches of government. You've got Trump unwilling to talk to Democrats at all. And he's saying, well, it's not worth it because they're all far left, whatevers. I wonder if it's that he can't handle a meeting. He can't possibly do that. But the Republicans control everything. But in order to get a budget through the Senate, they're going to need 60 votes because of the filibuster. And so they're going to have to get Democratic buy-in to that. And right now, it looks like they're not going to get it. The Democrats are saying that we won't consider this unless you are willing to bring back those tax credits so that people can get health care insurance. And the Republicans in the House forced through a continuing resolution that did not do that. And then they went on vacation, or not on vacation, they took off until after the deadline. because they're trying to jam the Democrats. And I think the Democrats, at least right now, are saying, forget it. We're not going to do this. The Democrats in the Senate. So, you know, again, the Republicans have this problem. They have set up the idea that nothing is better for the country than cutting taxes and cutting regulations. That's not what the American people want. The Republicans are in charge. Who knows what's going to happen here? But I think what we're seeing is sort of a breakdown of this whole idea that you could create this fantasy world of what a Trump presidency could look like. And now that rubber is meeting the road, it's all falling apart. And we're going to be left picking up the pieces. That's a bad position to be in a lot of ways, but it's also a very good position to be in because an awful lot of stuff is going to be on the table that wasn't even 5 years ago. This would be a good time to remember your neighbors who are hurting for food in this moment or who are frightened of ICE raids. And it would be a good time to remember to speak up and to continue to make community. I'm doing a big thing with Red, Wine, and Blue this week later on to emphasize that there are, I believe, 52,000 elections going on this fall in local elections, state elections, and that you can participate in all of those 52,000 elections that will change the direction of the country. And to remember that things, we're in this weird paradox where Trump and certainly the Supreme Court are doing authoritarian things. And yet as they do so, opposition to that is ramping up significantly. And the people defending the Constitution and democracy are scoring a lot of wins on that front. So lots hanging in the balance today, but it just feels a little bit like the tide changed over the last week. So we'll see. But I feel like that's happened for a long time. So maybe we still got a much longer way to go. The fact Robert Reich saw it too gives me a little bit of hope. A lot of people are really angry and really frightened by where we are. And I'm going to ask you to usually I just like answer your questions, but I'd like to put them in a bigger framework today, because what Donald Trump, especially, but now the MAGA Republicans are doing is they're trying to divide the American people into friends and enemies, which is something that happens in any society. I guess I shouldn't say any because I'm an Americanist. It certainly has happened in America before without there being explicitly, I think, an ideological component to that. But it is also something that political theorists have always said benefited the rise of a dictator. So nowadays on the radical right, people are reading a guy named Eric Schmidt, who was a political philosopher who became a Nazi. And he talks a lot about this division of the world into friends and enemies and the use of the state to hurt your enemies. Now, Trump's working really, really hard to make it seem as if the people who support Trump are the good guys, they're the friends, and everybody else is the enemies. And he did this in his first term by weaponizing the use of the word Democrat. So if you think about the way he reacted to the people who were working for the FBI and the Department of Justice, who were investigating his own administration for, I'm sorry, his campaign, his 2016 campaign for its ties to Russian operatives, they were all Republicans. I mean, he'd even appointed some of them, but he called them Democrats. When they started to work against him, he called them Democrats. And, you know, at one point, James Comey, who was the director of the FBI, who was a Republican, actually talked about that and said, you know, this is not the party that I signed up for. And if you remember in the first impeachment case, one Republican, and that was Mitt Romney of Utah, a Republican senator of Utah, voted to convict Trump on one count. And Trump promptly said that he was secretly working for the Democrats and that he was trying to infiltrate Trump's Republican administration and that he was actually helping the Democrats, which is very difficult to get your head around when you remember that Romney was actually the Republican Party's nominee for president in 2012, less than 10 years before all this transpired. So the idea that he was somehow a secret plant by the Democrats in the Republican Party is, you know, bonkers, right? But you can see this attempt to divide the country in two, the way he has been doing it, really taking off now. He's always done this, but really after the murder of Charlie Kirk, just about a week ago, there's been this litmus test that you have to not simply disavow violence, which virtually everybody has. There's always fringe people one place or another, but there's been a real outcry of this is not the way we want our country to go. But to lionize Kirk in ways that simply aren't true. I mean, as people point out, they're not actually using Kirk's words when they talk about how wonderful he is, because he was actually, you know, a real agitator and rabble rouser, and that's just who he was, you know? So there is this increasing attempt to say, to make this a litmus test. You have to be on our side. And they're going to take anything that they can spin as being offensive in order to create that other group. And you see this, I think, with the Kimmel monologue, which I listened to. I did all his monologues, in which he actually didn't say anything about Kirk, except a couple times to say how heinous the murder was. So, but what he really does is he says they're milking this for all it's worth. And then in those monologues, he skewers the president. I mean, he just skewers the president. Like I say, it's interesting to have watched this for me to have watched it, because I had never, I must have seen Kimmel at some point, but I'd certainly never seen his TV show. So it's kind of like what we call in my profession, the intelligent Martian, where you're like, what, you don't know the inside jokes, you don't know any of that stuff. So what is your impression? And mine was a pretty honest, this is really about the way he's talking about the president. So they're working really hard to do that, to create an us and a them, and then to use the power of the state against the them, against the enemies. It seems really pretty clear. And you saw last night that Trump posted on social media, or his account did. And I think it's going to be important to remember going forward that he is not always in charge of his account. There's other people who post on there. And so people are often writing, Trump said this, maybe did, maybe didn't, but it's more accurate to say his social media account said this. And his social media account said that he was going to designate, I have it right here, no, I don't. He was going to designate Antifa as a terrorist organization. And Antifa is a word that means anti-fascist, and he has claimed since his first term that it is an organized group that is essentially standing against him, and he says standing against law and order, although Antifa, according to his own FBI director in 2020, is just an ideology of people saying, we don't like fascists. You know, they're anti-fascists, and there's no group. There's no, you know, secret pinky swear or anything. So it's also not at all clear he can make that kind of a designation. But the idea is to say, anybody who disagrees with me is one of them. And us good guys all have to stay together. But there's something really interesting in that, in this moment. And that's that, think about it. There isn't an us versus them. Trump isn't an us. Trump is an I. You know, it's not like you can say, hey, there's these two contending groups and they want different things and all that. That's not the case here. Trump is one guy who demands absolute loyalty to himself, who is using the government for his own benefit and that of his family and his cronies. And you know, there's all those cartoons about how, you know, the new guy comes in like a toy and he's the best guy. And then, you know, he ends up getting thrown under the bus and then he's moved off stage. The other piece of that is that this construction of us versus them is not true on the Trump side, but it's also not true on the anti-Trump side. Which I think is one of the things that has frustrated so many people, is they keep waiting for someone to take over and someone to organize things and someone to push back against that them. But there isn't a them. There's a Trump and Trump loyalists, and then there's all the rest of us. And I would like to argue today, and maybe it's just because I spent so much time in the last 3 days with the Constitution, that's actually incredibly American. And it's actually incredibly powerful because, in fact, the United States of America is a really big country. And one of the things that Americans don't like and that is part of their birthright is they don't like to be told what to do. And they're not, you know, we're very much joiners. That's something all the way back to Tocqueville used to talk about. As Americans like groups, they like to hang out with their friends. But they're not big, let's all do this as a country kind of people. They're much more individualistic. And so in this moment, you think about the many different ways in which people are pushing back against Trump. And I'm just going to start listing some of the ways here. You have, of course, the lawsuits, and you have people calling their members of Congress and working at the state level and the local level to push back against the Trump administration. But you also have boycotts. And a lot of people have looked for a national strike. And I have never really supported a national strike because, as a historian, I know that in the past, national strikes tend to backfire against the people making them because they are too general and they end up hurting people who don't understand what's going on and feel that they turn against the people organizing the strikes. But boy, do targeted boycotts work. Take a look at what happened to Tesla. Right now, it's not clear what's going to happen with Jimmy Kimmel, in part because people are madly canceling their Disney Channel. And there's a whole list of people companies associated with ABC News and Disney. I'm sorry, not ABC News, with the ABC Channel and Disney that are really, truly vulnerable to people saying, okay, you don't want us to participate? We're out of here. You have in a number of both national and local levels, and I love this, you have local town meetings, for example, issuing resolutions against the Trump administration, complaining about what they've done, calling them out for things, which I love. Just today, you've had lawmakers arrested in New York City because they weren't allowed in to examine the conditions under which ICE was holding detainees. My point here is that one of the things that I think we're seeing is a lot of Americans protesting this administration in their own way, whichever feels the most frustrating and the most dangerous to them. And that's not a weakness, that's an extraordinary strength, because it's extremely difficult to bear down on 341 million people all protesting in different ways. I want to set up this theory first, this ideological stance. If you stop thinking about the country as us versus them and start thinking about it as the American people versus an autocrat, the lens changes a lot, doesn't it? And one of the reasons that I've been thinking about this is not only because of the smart people I talk to, but because you know who came out against the firing of Jimmy Kimmel last night? I didn't believe it was real. I actually made sure from a lot of sources it was real. Tucker Carlson. And when Tucker Carlson, who was a right-wing broadcaster, talked about why free speech is important, damned if he didn't echo James Madison, which says that, you know, I keep saying this to you, that at the end of this, whatever is coming, the political alliances are not going to be what we expect them to be. And if you disagree with that, look at the fact that two of the other people who have stood up in the last week against Trump is John Yoo, who was the guy who wrote the torture memo for the Bush administration saying they could go ahead and torture people no matter what Congress said, and Karl Rove, who was one of the Republican gurus who put this Republican Party in power. You're starting to see people standing up against this regime from places you do not expect them to stand up. And as an example of where this might go, I would like to point out to you that one of the people standing most strongly for the rights of Americans, including a very recent social media post about the rights of transgender Americans, is Bill Kristol. Bill Kristol, who was a neocon, a neoconservative. We are rethinking our partisanship in this moment around our defense of democracy. And if you think about it that way, and you stop thinking, oh, Trump's got all this power, and then we're the weenies over here, and start thinking about it as what America has always done really well is we the people defending our rights against some upstart who wants to take them away. So try and reframe it that way, and let me push you a little bit further on that. A number of questions here that I'm going to tie into this. Somebody said, how on earth can you say that this administration is weak when they hold all the cards? First of all, this administration is enormously unpopular. A new study out, I think it was today, by The Economist, hardly a left-wing publication, it tends to slide right, shows that Trump has negative 17 points. He is underwater by 17 points. And it also shows that his popularity has gone whoop over the last week or so. He's down real fast, and that's before the firing of Jimmy Kimmel. His popularity is extraordinarily low. And why does that matter? It matters because the American people are not behind what is happening with the administration. And he is underwater on every single issue, including the economy and deportations, which were the two things he won election on. So there is that, the fact that he is unpopular, but you can also tell they know he is unpopular by how hard they are trying to crack down. They are trying to look strong because they do not have control. And again, one of the things I was thinking of when I was thinking about this today and about what I'm talking about, we the people versus a regime. Imagine a room full of fourth graders. Those of you who've had children or have been in education, you know, If you really are in control of your classroom, you don't have to yell. You don't have to, maybe you have to raise your voice sometimes, but you got the guardrails, right? And the students know how to behave, and they tend to behave. If you don't have control of a fourth grade classroom and they're running around like rabbits, there's no way you're going to reclaim control over them. And what often happens is a teacher who cannot control that classroom screams more and more and more and louder and louder and louder. And all it does is it makes the students laugh. I mean, some of the students cower, sure, but the rest of them laugh and they turn worse. And all of you know that dynamic. If you haven't had to be in charge of a classroom like that or had a child in a classroom like that, we were in classrooms like that as kids, right? Think about it that way. They're trying to crack down so hard because they know they are losing control of the American people. They're also losing control of Trump's ability to handle the presidency. Watch him. Watch the fact that he was just in the UK and Melania Trump, the First Lady of the United States, held his hand a lot. She is famous for not touching him. It looked as if he was having trouble. He needed to have somebody holding his hand. He's having trouble articulating things. He's not remembering faces. He is in increasingly poor shape. And it increasingly looks as if the power of the administration is flowing to Russell Vogt at the Office of Management and Budget, who is a key writer of Project 2025, and Stephen Miller, the deputy White House chief of staff, who is behind the immigration policies and increasingly seemingly other stuff as well. They don't have, and they are not elected officials, and they're trying to do as much as they possibly can, or seem to be trying as much as they possibly can, while he is still in charge of the government.